This is a Times Online podcast.
The Bugle, audio newspaper for a visual world.
Hello, Buglers, and welcome to issue 64 of The Bugle, the world's greatest ever audio newspaper for a visual world, for the week beginning Monday, the 16th of February, 2009, with me, Andy Zaltzman, here in London and in New York City, New York. It's John Oliver.
Hello, Andy.
Hello.
Hello, Buglers. How are you doing, Andy?
I'm okay, John, although my daughter's got a bit of croup, so I didn't get a lot of sleep last night. It's a kind of honky, walrus-like cough, respiratory problem.
I will tell her to grow up.
I'll do that.
Or to continue growing up. And all the best with it. I've had a very strange few days, Andy. I spent the last 2 days at the White House. Yeah, that White House. Not a White House, the first one you thought of.
Oh, right, because I live in a White House.
Right. That's right, I wasn't there. You will have noticed that I wasn't in it. No, I was at the White House doing a piece on the press corps. And I've got to tell you, Andy, and I can't believe I'm saying this, I am sorry that we tried to burn that place down in 1814. Yeah, I've said it. It's an incredible place. I don't know what we were thinking. In fact, I'd like to apologise on behalf of my entire country, something I'm in no way qualified to do, for attempting to torch one of the most fantastic buildings in the world. While I was there, I got to spend 8 minutes with Press Secretary Robert Gibbs, and I think he spent at least 7 of those 8 minutes wondering why he had thought that that would be a good idea. And I'm not sure that if he ever came up with a satisfactory answer for himself on that one. And tomorrow, I can't believe I'm saying this, I'm flying down to Austin in Texas to do a gig for and with Bill Clinton. There's a Clinton Global Initiative event down there, and it's going to be me, him, and Natalie Portman.
Something for everyone.
That's right. I'm going to be spending Valentine's Day with Bill Clinton and Natalie Portman. I'm guessing that aside from doing stand-up, my role is chiefly going to be to keep him away from her. The worst case scenario is I should have some spectacular stories from that for next week's Bugle.
Anyway, I've got a quick pigeon update for you as well, John.
Oh, yeah. What's the pigeon news?
The little bastards have gone. Vamoosed. They vamoosed back to pigeon land or wherever it was they came from. They're not welcome in my house, John. And more importantly, they're not welcome on my house. And if they come back, John, so help me. I will call the council and get them to put more plastic spikes up. That's how strongly I feel about this matter.
So, no, but you are completely without pigeons now.
Yeah, but we have got a starling nest, and starlings are an endangered species, and they can't be touched. Just shit versions of dinosaurs.
Is that what you were screaming up at your roof? You are just shit dinosaurs.
Well, it's the 16th of February, this issue, which means, John, it is 86 years to the day since Egyptology megastar Howard Carter popped open the door to the little pint-sized pharaoh Tutankhamun's cosy little burial chamber. "Mummy!" he cried in celebration as he crowbarred open the needlessly flashy coffin and saw the bandage-covered figure within. His mother, you see, had a habit of sleepwalking into the giant vats of boiling marmalade that little Howard used to make as a teenage fruit preserve entrepreneur, and therefore spent most of her life covered head to toe in bandages, so you could understand his confusion. Howard unwrapped the ancient swaddling to reveal a shriveled human form beneath. "It's a boy!" he yelped excitedly. "I'm going to call him Rupert." "Oh, shit, he's not breathing!" Howard frantically gave King Tut some serious mouth-to-mouth, whilst illegally stealing some of the dead pharaoh's bling in explicit contravention of his excavation licence from the Egyptian government. "Come on, Lord Carnarvon," he shouted to his boss and funder. "Help me give the lad some CPR." "Righto," said Lord Carnarvon, strapping on an electric guitar and starting to sing Bad Moon Rising. "No, no," said Carter. "CPR, not CCR." "Oh," said Lord Carnarvon. "CPR, what's that? Credence Clearwater Revival?" "No," said Howard, snogging away at the millennia-old corpse like a male teenage frog, smooching a princess in the hope of turning her into a sweet little frogette. "Cardiopulmonary resuscitation." "Oh," said Carnarvon. "I don't know any of their songs. Can I do Have You Ever Seen the Rain?" "No," said Howard. "It's too late. He's gone." He looked at his watch. "Time of death, 1324 BC. "Hey, do you think we'll be cursed for breaking into the pharaoh's tomb, Howard?" asked Lord Carnarvon. "Nah, mate, we'll be fine. As long as you put your anti-curse cream on, you need at least factor 15 for a tomb like that." "Oh, crumbs," panicked Carnarvon. "I knew my toothpaste tasted funny this morning," he said, dropping dead. Howard downed the rest of his and his dead patron's drinks. "Tutankhamun," he chuckled to himself. "What a shame you'll never get to meet Woody Allen's long-standing 1980s girlfriend. Hello, who are you?" "Mia Farrow." "No, Mia Farrow." "Dinner?" "Dinner." "Hey, what was Sinatra like in the sack?" "Frank." "Yeah, tell me everything." 86 years ago.
What else have you done this week apart from that?
Well, to be honest, not a lot. Looked up a few cricket stats from my cricket blog, and that's it. As always, some sections of the Bugle are going straight in the bin, including this week a snooping section, eavesdropping, the do's and don'ts of listening in on other people's conversations. Do, keep still, keep quiet, and make sure your electromagnetic listening device has fresh batteries in it. Don't, ask prior permission to install a hidden microphone under the coffee table of your subject. Snoop first, ask questions later. Do, wear neutral clothes and sit a couple of tables away from your subject in a cafe. Don't, repeatedly smile maniacally at them, pull a funny face and say, "Don't mind me, just carry on talking to each other. I'm only leaning towards you because I have a muscular spasm in my lower right lumbar region and my chair is on a geological fault line." Do collate all your information in a well-organised file, make several copies of it and keep them locked in a vault before presenting the package to your subjects and blackmailing them by saying that if they don't pay you, you'll reveal to the local media or their family the full details of either their plot to kill the president, their affair with the local librarian assessor, or their deliberations over whether to get plain or pattern curtains for their spare room. Delete as appropriate. And don't interrupt their conversation from your hiding place in a cupboard in their bedroom with the answer to a trivia question. That's all in the bin, along with an amphibious vehicle section, how to turn your Vespa scooter into a working yacht, and a product recall for the new Frampton Frogmobile, a vehicle made by 1960s rock guitar legend Peter Frampton, which moves by bouncy jumping on land and by doing breaststroke in the water. The Frogmobile, modelled on the Australian Rocket Frog, can leap up to 800 yards at a time, but this resulted in a series of near-fatal crashes as drivers smashed at high velocity into the windows of tall buildings. Frampton also blamed the vehicle's commercial failure on the fact that drivers of the female range of Frogmobile objected to their vehicles laying thousands of spawn in their garages, some of which matured into full-size unwanted Frogmobiles.
Top story this week, sorry seems to be the easiest word. The former bosses of two of the biggest UK banking casualties have apologised profoundly and unreservedly for their bank's failure. Quick thing on that, Andy, it is their failure, not their bank's. It's a minor point, but it does feel like it's worth making. Their bank is an abstract concept, a building, a collection of disparate people's monies gathered together in a complicated investment scenario. They, however, are a very literal pair of arseholes.
Yeah, this apology, John, was not so much half-arsed as containing barely detectable traces of buttock. Some people thought they might have spotted some... Some people thought they might have spotted some slightly flabby, pimpled flesh that might have been a bit of an arse, but it turned out to have been a slice of grapefruit in a funny light. Well, as you said, John, Elton John, very wrong on this one. Sorry seems to be the hardest words he sang. The pop singer, Sister Sledge collaborator, astronaut, bottle historian and Keynesian economist.
Oh, come on, Andy, he's only four of those things.
Like so much of what Elton has had to say over the years, John, this has proved completely untrue. Other examples include when he said, "Saturday night's all right for fighting." Untrue, it's actually very good for fighting, if you're into that kind of thing. In fact, most of the world's top championship boxing bouts do take place on Saturday nights to maximise TV revenue.
That is true.
And also in the 1980s song Nikita, he said, "Oh, Nikita, you will never know anything about my home." Of course, at that stage, Elton John clearly had not foreseen the mid-1990s documentary Tantrums and Tiaras, filmed by his partner David Furnish, which actually included quite candid scenes shot in Elton's own house.
He also said, "I'm a rocket man, Andy," despite the fact that his feet have rudimentary jet propulsion.
But the point is, as you say, sorry was in fact quite an easy word to say. The difficult words to say turned out to be any that gave even the slightest hint that they even marginally meant it. Their apology, John, was a bit like a man who's just sliced your pet guinea pig in half with a hacksaw, apologising not for slicing your guinea pig in half with a hacksaw, but expressing regret that a sharp, serrated blade can adversely impact on guinea pig flesh when applied in a repetitive slicing motion.
Former Royal Bank of Scotland chief executive Sir Fred Goodwin said he could not be more sorry for what happened. The former bank chief also said that the bonus culture had contributed to the crisis and needed to be reviewed. Oh, no shit! Any more pearls of retrospective wisdom they'd like to throw our way? That's like the ex-mayor of Pompeii saying he felt their city had a volcano problem. We are currently covered in 60 foot of ash and pumice. I think now is the time to review our policy of being erupted on. In hindsight, it was a bad idea.
Yeah, bonus culture has been under attack, John. The bankers themselves have even admitted it has been a problem. And Prime Minister Gordon Brown has said that he is really cross about it. Really, really cross. And if they don't do something about it, he's going to have their guts for garters. Which I should say is different from what he said when he went to a French offal speciality restaurant last week when he said he would have their guts for starters.
Thank you very much.
I'm here all week. The culture of rewarding risk rather than good practice has taken hold of the banking world. And, John, this, to me, seems a bit like paying a surgeon more if he uses a chainsaw instead of a scalpel, because it looks cooler, makes more noise and generates more blood. And I guess, as Aristotle himself once said, if it ain't hurting, it ain't working. Although, to be fair to Aristotle, he did have a very unorthodox attitude to gherkin eating.
And to be really fair to him, he did never say that.
Well, he did believe that if you didn't stick your gherkin fork through the roof of your mouth, you wouldn't get any nutritional value from your pickle, and also might incur the wrath of Kornikos, the god of gherkins. Strange man. Clever, but strange. But the bankers have expressed concern, though, John, that if they're not paid enough, a lot of top bankers might leave the banking sector and go to work elsewhere, to which the obvious layman's response is, oh, good, problem solved. Right off, then. Let's get some orangutans in their places and see if they can bring a bit of stability to the situation. They couldn't get it more wrong, surely. They might smear bananas all over their computer screens and wank on their keyboards, but that's an expense that can be withstood if it means they don't gamble billions and billions of billions and billions of pounds on a fiscal hunch.
But at least they have come forward. That's all anyone really wants, Andy. They want a belated, semi-sincere apology. Oh, no, I'm sorry. They want their jobs and homes back. Yes, that's it. I got confused.
But you can't have everything, John.
No, you can only have one of those. Otherwise, that is exactly the kind of greed that got us into this mess. During the hearings, the Commons Select Committee asked aggressive questions, but were accused of not delivering a knockout blow. And I think that's because people are now angry enough to want to see actual physical violence break out. There wasn't a single person in that room who wouldn't have seriously benefited from a slap across the face. Gordon Brown was also himself grilled by the Commons Committee, and of course, back when our country was great, Andy, we'd have considered actually grilling him. Taking him to the tower, basting him in barbecue sauce, and grilling him until he either came up with a concrete solution to Britain's economic woes or became delicious. But knowing British food, Andy, we'd only have overcooked him.
Well, that's what we did with Thomas Cranmer.
Let the meat speak for itself.
I really had to. They just had to totally douse him in ketchup to even make him worth eating at all.
It was a real insult to injury for him. Why bother eating rosemary for the previous 2 weeks?
Exactly.
There have been similar hearings this side of the Atlantic pond, Andy, as new details emerge in the Bernie Madoff scandal. Now, you may remember Bernie Madoff as the man who has for months been brutally confined to his multi-million dollar Parkview penthouse since being exposed as the architect of a $50 billion Ponzi scheme. Which, I have to say, Andy, really gives a bad name to the many legitimate Ponzi businesses out there. I myself worked my way through college selling Ponzi's. You might remember Ponzi's as the Christmas toy craze of 1998. A Ponzi was a cuddly investment banker who, if you pulled his string, would tell you how to triple your pocket money. The latest list of Madoff's victims has been released, featuring such luminaries as Steven Spielberg, John Malkovich, Jar Jar Gabor, and Kevin Bacon, who, as a result of this, is now only 6 degrees from bankruptcy. But the troubling revelation in all this is that a man called Harry Markopoulos had spent the last 9 years sending the SEC documents exposing the Madoff system as fraudulent. And in the congressional hearing, he said, I gift-wrapped and delivered the largest Ponzi scheme in history to them, and somehow they couldn't be bothered to conduct a thorough and proper investigation. I gave them a roadmap and a flashlight to find the fraud. But hold on, Harry. Sure, a roadmap and a flashlight, but to be fair, you didn't give them snacks for the journey or warm clothing in case they got chilly. They couldn't be expected to go out without those.
And they only had a tape of Bonnie Tyler's greatest hits to see them through.
So you'd think that this would have been a good time for the SEC to take a leaf from the British bank executives and at least try to fake looking sorry. But instead, one of them at one point referred to this alleged Ponzi scheme that allegedly resulted in substantial losses to investors. What? What is alleged about this? It's already happened. The money's gone. You've got a 300-page document accumulated over the last decade explaining why it's gone, and Madoff himself has confessed. You really don't need to be Matlock to bring this case home.
Well, this crisis, John, has taught us that no matter how bad business has been, I think everyone deserves a bonus. And this was proved last year by Alan H. Fishman, who joined American megabank Washington Mutual on 8th of September. He left 3 weeks and a record-breaking bankruptcy later, $19 million richer, courtesy of a $7.5 million signing on fee, an $11.6 million cash severance, and $4 he won on the office fruit machine before moonwalking out of the building and high-fiving himself so hard that he dislocated both wrists.
Bonuses should work for comedians as well, though, Andy. If you singularly fail to make a single person laugh during a gig, you should still get a bonus standing ovation at the end.
God, if only that had applied when we did that gig in York together about 4 years ago.
We'd have had bonuses coming out of our wazoos.
I think there could well have been a Commons inquiry after that gig.
Promised Land news now, and Andy, you in particular, shouldn't have had to read or watch the news to find out what happened in Israel this week. You should have just felt it. You should have flipped your judar on and felt a disturbance in the force. Because Israel staged an election this week, which came to a satisfactory non-conclusion, with both Netanyahu and Livni claiming victory. Perfect. That is just what that region needs. More arguing. That whole area bottles things up way too much. Won't somebody just say what they really think?
It is starting to look, though, that Israeli politicians just like a squabble. Yep. Any squabble, and this one, I guess, this election squabble, is rendered slightly more difficult than the recent squabble in Gaza, because God didn't make the squabble result clear several thousand years ago. So I guess that just muddies the water slightly.
Complex. God should have made another promise.
The governing Kadima Party and right-wing Likud Party are neck and neck in the proportional representation system, leaving the balance of power in the clenched, angry hands of some of Israel's more right-wing and perhaps peace-averse political practitioners, such as Avigdor Lieberman of the nationalist Israeli Beitenu Party, who are what might be described as Arab sceptic. What does this result herald for the peace process, John? Well, I think we can be pretty sure that whoever ends up in government will probably resolve any lingering niggles residing from the recent Gaza schmozzle and other outbreaks of armed bickering that have poxed the region over the last, say, 6,000 years.
Schmozzle.
That's the official UN definition of it.
It wasn't a war. It wasn't an incident. Yeah. It was a schmozzle.
Yeah, that's right. Don't blame me. Blame the UN. It was Peres de Cuellar reporting these definitions. So I think they're all going to live happily ever after, John. That's my prediction. What do you think?
Yeah, why not? Yeah, I'll come in on that. Yeah, yeah, I'll put $2 down on that.
Yeah, but I have to. I'm quite a peace fan to say. I think peace is ace. I love it. I can't really stand war, mate. I'm just not interested. I'd rather kick back in a hammock for an afternoon reading the 1950s sports magazines I've just bought on eBay than waste a day engaged in a savage gunfight in a shattered urban landscape of devastation and sorrow. Any
day. Say that, Andy. Don't knock it till you try.
Well, that's just so much more relaxing, John. It's, you know, peace is like a nice, long, relaxing day at a health spa without getting shot at by a helicopter. And if peace was a cake, I'd eat it.
Yeah, but if war was a cake, you'd eat that too. You just like cake. Tzipi Livni narrowly won victory, but may lose out anyway to Netanyahu, who may argue that he's in a better position to create a coalition government. Mr. Netanyahu said that with God's help, he would lead the next government. You know what? Why doesn't God just sit this one out, Andy? I think he's helped that region out quite enough, what with his constant promises. One thing is clear, and that is that the kingmaker will now be third-party Yisrael Beiteinu leader Avigdor Lieberman. And you couldn't hope for a nicer kingmaker. If, that is, your only two choices were him or Stalin. Because, amongst other inclusive policies, he is for loyalty oaths and the execution or expulsion of Arab Israelis. Well, I can't see any reason why he shouldn't have a very positive effect on Israel's prime ministerial selection. If, again, he's willing not to vocalise any of the thoughts or opinions inside his head. One possible suggestion at the moment going around is that each person gets to be prime minister for 2 years, rotating midway through the 4-year term. What? This isn't a cake that kids need to share. This is this kind of political attempt at the wisdom of Solomon? Well, you can each have half of it. Oh, well, I don't want it then.
Valentine's Day news, and the British Library has published a love letter from Henry VIII to Anne Boleyn, who later became his second wife. And in this letter, John, he pulled out all the stops to get into Foxy Anne's corsetry. This is some of the things that he wrote in it. The demonstrations of your affection are such that they really oblige me to honour, love and serve you forever. For my part,
yeah!
I will outdo you if this be possible, rather than reciprocate in the loyalty of my heart and my desire to please you. I assure you that henceforth my heart will be dedicated to you alone, and wishing greatly that my body was so too.
He then X-rated!
He then drew a little heart with her initials in, John.
Oh.
But of course, what he didn't say in that letter was, but if you so much as look at another man or fail to provide me with a son and heir, I will lop your bonce off. Do you get me, Anne? With an axe. I don't care how peachy your bloopers are. I'm the king. See that neck of yours? Do you want to keep it in one piece? Or would you prefer it to be whacked in half and splurting blood all over the front three rows of the crowd at your execution? Whoosh! I want a one-chop shop. Whoosh! Where are you heading off to? Whoosh! Oh, look, your scarf doesn't fit so well anymore, does it? Whoosh! Executee! Oh, yeah, she was pretty fit. Whoosh! What's my favourite type of oriental noodle soup? Alaxa! Whoosh! Alaxa? Never mind. What do you mean there's no next time? This is no next time! Whoosh! Does that work logically? Near enough. Whoosh! One portion of Amberlin, please, mate. Certainly, sir. Salt? Yes. Vinegar? Yeah. Head? No, thanks. Whoosh! Lots of love, Henry. P.S. I love you so much, I'll split the Christian church in two. I'm not just saying that. I'll do it.
That man had a way with words.
He sure did.
Kill your jets, Henry. You had me at neck severing.
Other news now, and a giant white horse has been chosen as a new £2 million piece of art for southeast of England. John, it's going to be installed near Ebbsfleet in Kent. It's been dubbed the Angel of the South. Of course, John, the white horse has been a symbol of the great county of Kent for a long time. But there's an interesting side angle to this, John. My sister, Helen, has just been staying in San Jose, and her hotel room looked out on a three-storey high horse sculpture.
Right.
And the upshot of this was that it left them, when they opened their hotel curtains in the morning, greeted by the quite unmissable opportunity to, not to put too fine a point on it, look straight into a gigantic horse's anus. So, the great county of Kent got, John, the Garden of England, albeit some parts of that garden are industrial wastelands. That county, John, will soon be proud owner of the world's biggest horse penis and horse balls. And I think it's appropriate that, John, Kent should be adorned by an unfeasibly massive horse's arsehole, because I grew up in Kent, John. And what finer tribute could my county pay to me for my work on the Bugle generating copious quantities of horse shit than this massive horse's arsehole?
To quote Matilda, Andy, grow up. This has been called the Angel of the South. It's not the Angel of the South, Andy. The Angel of the North is called the Angel of the North because it's a f***ing angel. This is a horse. It's the horse of the South. Angel of the North, horse of the South. There's nothing wrong with calling something the horse of the South.
Bugle feature section, and it's a very special section this week. It's a competition to find out who is the greatest 200-year-old person in the world. And the qualification for this, John, is to have turned 200 between the 1st of February and the 16th of February 2009. Now, that, of course, does narrow it down somewhat.
So it rules me out.
It does rule you out, John. Yeah, even if you were 200 years old, you wouldn't even be in the running, John.
Oh, come on, you don't know that. What might I have done with the other 169 years? I don't know that.
I don't know, John, but I'm guessing your ratings on The Daily Show would have been lower in the 1840s.
It can't have been much lower.
So the candidates, I mean, there's two big guns we'll cut to in a minute. Fringe candidates, you've got Cyrus Hall McCormick, John.
Yeah, happy birthday, Cyrus.
He invented the first ever horse-drawn reaper, John, the forerunner and inspiration for today's combine harvesters that we know and love.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, well, frankly, revolutionised farming, and that's played an incidental but key role in the urbanisation of the United States of America, leading thus to inner-city crime and drugs problems that scar the US today. So I guess, in sum, Cyrus McCormick was a bad influence. Disqualified.
Yeah, you're not telling me any of that, Andy, you're reminding me. That is not new information.
But obviously the two big guns, John, both celebrated their birthday on the 12th of February. Charles Darwin and Abraham Lincoln. Two lives of just non-stop competition between these two big rivals.
Competition.
It's like competition, but slightly more twittish. Throughout their lives, John, they were at each other hammer and tongs. Firstly, they had a competition to see who could formulate a theory of evolution. Mm-hmm. One up to Darwin, of course. Then who could grow the bigger beard? Now, of course, Lincoln didn't disgrace himself, but Darwin came through late in his old age to take the points. I guess you got to think what Lincoln could have achieved with his beard if he hadn't gone to one play too many. I guess we'll just never know. Then they contested on the ability to talk about tortoises for the longest time, including recipes for tortoise-based dishes. And again, Darwin won that convincingly. Then they came to who can be 17th president of the USA. Nil-nil. Lincoln peaked too early at the 16th president. Darwin was never even close, but still, no score. Then they had a competition to see who can marry the most cousins. 1-0 to Charles Darwin, but a win's a win. Then who can stay alive the longest? Again, Darwin took that one. And it was 5-0, John, and Lincoln finally, a consolation victory. Best impersonation of a condor eating a plate of worms. No contest. 5-1 to Charles Darwin. Abraham Lincoln, president, but more importantly, loser. Incidentally, John, tomorrow, Saturday, of course, as we record on the Friday, is Valentine's Day. And Darwin was such an incurable romantic that when he was contemplating marrying his cousin, he wrote out two columns headed Marry and Not Marry, and then wrote out a list of pros and cons of marriage.
Now, is that true?
This is true, yeah. Oh,
scientifically romantic.
Yeah. And he wrote some absolutely fantastic things. He wrote, in favour of marriage, you get a constant companion, an object to be beloved and played with, his words.
I'd rephrase the object thing there, Charlie.
And he wrote in brackets, better than a dog, anyhow.
Oh, my God.
So, clearly, he really, really loved his cousin. Another plus, someone to take care of the house. Not exactly a modern man. And also the charms of music and female chit-chat. These things are good for one's health, he wrote. But then on the minus side, forced to visit and receive relations and terrible loss of time. Testify.
That all true?
Yes, it's all true. In favour of not marrying, he writes, the freedom to go where one likes, choice of society, and more importantly, little of it. Quite an antisocial man by the looks of it. But also, more importantly, you get to enjoy, quote, the conversation of clever men at clubs.
I hope his cousin slash wife looked at him and said, hey, Charles, when are you going to evolve into something that isn't a f-wit?
Anyway, he swung around in the end and decided to marry his cousin. When he said, never mind, old boy, cheer up, one cannot live this solitary life with groggy old age, friendless and cold and childless, staring one in the face. And this swung it, John. Picture to yourself a nice, soft wife on a sofa with a good fire. You must marry. So there you go. What a romantic.
He was like the 19th century's R. Kelly.
Your emails now, and thank you once again for your emails, many of which have been lampooning Britain for its low-grade response to a small amount of snow. Your criticisms and comments are duly noted and will be acted upon in a future millennium. This email, however, comes from Tom in Manchester, who writes on the subject of Zaltzman career update. Dear Bugle Kaisers, I thought I'd drop you a line to inform Andy that he has reached a new accolade as an author. His book has turned up in a charity shop in Manchester. Well, he'll be glad to know that he has sold more than the one copy which I purchased in a fit of optimism and drunkenness. Brackets, it really is very good. Andy will no doubt be disheartened to know that someone decided to hold on to the book for less than 6 months. Well, in fact, it's actually less than 3 months since it was published.
Yeah.
That has got unwanted Christmas present written all over it. So there you go, John. John, he continues, now there is a challenge for you to get your book into a second-hand bookshop in even less time, if you can tear yourself away from your part-time job to bother writing one.
Part-time? Ouch. Listen, I'll work harder than I'd ever planned on doing.
Yeah, well, come on, John, what's it? You know, the whole show is, what, 22 minutes a day, 4 days a week? Come on, it's 88 minutes and you're not even on most of it. What's it, about 10 minutes work a week? Oh, dear dums. Oh, man, I'm down a mine. I don't work down a mine 60 hours a week.
No, you
a
don't,
joke,
Andy.
A joke mine.
Oh, it's a joke mine, that's right, yeah. There's an email here from Mary Kerrigan who says, dear Andy and John, in alphabetical order so as not to cause offence. Still caused offence. I downloaded all Bugle episodes on January the 25th and finished listening to them all in the early hours of the morning on February the 4th, a feat which was educational, entertaining and downright sexual. What? I had not read ahead there. I presume that's a joke. During this marathon, I heard something that truly amazed me. During episode 13, first broadcast January the 18th, 2008, you had a feature in which Andy interviewed some animals, including dogs, a cat, an elephant, and most importantly, a chicken. This chicken correctly predicted the global economic crisis, and I'm writing to you primarily to inquire whether you're still in contact with this economically gifted chicken. Would it be possible to hear this chicken's view on the bailout plan, or has it already been turned into McNuggets? Yours, Mary Kerrigan. I guess that just goes to show what chickens are capable of, Andy.
Oh, it's interesting you don't remember it, John, because I believe that episode featured your then-girlfriend.
Yes, that's right. I mean, in terms of whether we're still in contact with that economically gifted chicken, I'm afraid that chicken and I... Anyway, let's not dwell on that. Things didn't work out with that chicken. The chicken and I lived in different countries.
Yeah, the chicken just couldn't fly across the Atlantic.
Well, I'm afraid that is both literally and metaphorically true.
Well, John, our amazing prophetic powers are proved by this email from Connor Darrell, Trinity College Dublin, who writes on the subject Sausage Forecast, which coincidentally was the name of a band I used to be in. Connor writes, "Hey guys, gotta congratulate you on your expertise with Americo-Carnomancy, the art of using American meat products to predict the future. You told us last February in episode 15 that we were headed for a recession, despite oil prices being more expensive than Africa. Mazel tov!" So I concur that common sense and the shitty sense of foreboding of the time may have been warning enough. Cheers, Connor. I think Connor's got quite a good point there. He's got two good points. One, that we do know what's going to happen in the future. And two, that economically speaking, so did anyone else who was taking a blindest bit of notice. And I guess, you know, that's all very well with hindsight, or foresight, to give it its technical term, predictive hindsight.
Well, sausage sight.
So maybe we should start hacking open some corn dogs to see what's going to happen next year.
You just like saying that.
Yeah,
corn dog.
Might tell me who's going to win Wimbledon. Well, it's going to be Federer or Nadal, but, you know, might say which one of those two. And this one comes from Guy Yedwab in Irvine, California.
Good name.
It's an excellent name. Who writes, "Having passed a suitable period of mourning from the end of Hot Eastern history, I knew deep in my heart that it would replace itself. Spontaneously, like Jesus appearing in the loins of the Virgin Mary." Interesting. It's like, is that like his face sometimes appears in biscuits? Very skillfully avoided making a pubic topiary joke there. "In what," he continues, "I can only guess was a very uncomfortable religious experience. And it seems my fellow buglers have spoken. The new permanent replacement to the Hotties from History section should be death threats against the Bugle."
Yeah, that's true.
We are getting now probably enough that we probably ought technically to inform the police.
Yeah, and as our producer was saying, you just can't be 100% sure as you're laughing through them that one isn't going to slip through and actually be accurate.
So Guy continues, "If you do not replace the Hotties from History with death threats against the Bugle section, I will kill you."
It's still up in the air whether, like Lazarus, Hotties from History comes back.
Do keep your emails coming in to thebugle@timesonline.co.uk.
Lazarus himself, of course, a hottie.
Sport now, and, well, there's only one big story in the world of sport at the moment, and it's not the Alex Rodriguez drug story. It's not even England being bowled out for 51 by the West Indies, or Chelsea sacking a manager who won the World Cup with Brazil because they weren't doing very well for a couple of weeks. No, it's an 11-year-old matador killing six bulls.
Yes. This matador has been bullfighting since he was 4 years old, and that's pretty impressive, Andy. I'd barely been bull-looking when I was 4 years old. I'm not sure I'd looked at a bull at that point, let alone fought one.
The child matador is called Miguelito Lagravere, and he is half French, half Mexican. And, John, surely this must be the ideal genetic makeup for bullfighting.
Why is that?
You're combining the Mexican refusal to go down in a fight and the French willingness to obliterate animals for pure, unadulterated fun.
He has proved to be a very controversial figure in Spain, Andy, with both animal rights groups and child welfare agencies expressing their concern. And he said in response, "No one is forcing them to watch bullfights or to keep informed about them. It's as if I told a boy who does motocross not to do it. It's very bothersome."
Lagravere, who lists as an 11-year-old amongst his hobbies watching cartoons, eating jelly, giggling at the word willy, and killing bulls for the entertainment of others, has hit back at critics saying, "Cut me some slack, I'm only small." And his parents, John, realised at the age of four that he had a gift for it when they took him to a Christmas pantomime, and he vaulted onto the stage and stuck a ceremonial sword into the pantomime cow with a rare flamboyance, leaving one actor dead and one very angry. You know, really, when you think about this, it's bullfighting is like women's tennis. Now, those British parents just aren't willing to send their kids off to bullfighting school young enough to compete at the top level anymore. And, we, you know, we shouldn't mock this guy. He's going to be the Maria Sharapova of bullfighting. But it's quite an extraordinary thing for us, with our British sensibilities, to see this child killing six bulls in a single fight. And I think as bullfight fan Ernest Hemingway would probably have said, "Shit, it's a kid fighting a bull! I've got to write about this! Look at the boy go! Look at his little legs! Look at him run! Go on, boy! Stab the bovine bastards! Yay! Save him some carpaccio for me, little fella! Where's my typewriter? Oh, bollocks, I've left my adjectives at home again."
Oh, such a sparse use of words from Hemingway.
So has the A-Rod story, has that been pretty big stateside, John?
A-Rod, I mean, what a hero, Andy. Very cleverly saying that he hasn't taken steroids since the last time he failed the test. Good point. That is when he took his last steroid.
But it's kind of odd, isn't it, that drugs weren't illegal in baseball at that point. So it is perhaps not surprising that so many players took the shortcut to success. So I guess it's a bit like leaving a packet of sausages on your car roof overnight to make sure that you don't forget to drive them to Mike and Ethel's barbecue, and then being disappointed to find in the morning that a fox had eaten them and not even left you a thank you note. I think that probably encapsulates baseball's attitude towards drug taking. And as for England being bowled out for 51 in the West Indies, some people said it's the most embarrassing day in English cricket history, and therefore the most embarrassing day in world history. But I think I'd rather put it down to a kind of post-colonial guilt complex. It wasn't that bad. It was that bad. I can barely look my copies of Wisden in the face anymore. Bugle forecast now, and, well, John, I guess the forecast has to centre around your momentous summit meeting with Bill Clinton.
That's right, that's exactly what it is.
With you cast very much in the Boris Yeltsin role. Well, best of luck. Who is Clinton going to go for, Portman or Oliver?
Let's put that in full context, Portman or Oliver in a dress. Respect the office, Andy.
And finally, 2009 is, as I'm sure none of you need me to remind you, the United Nations International Year of Natural Fibres. So next week's Bugle will be made of a natural flax-hemp combination instead of sound waves and cyberspace like normal. Until then, happy bullshitting!
Bye!
This is a Times Online podcast. For more podcasts, go to timesonline.co.uk/podcasts.